Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 13, delivered on March 2, 2010. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 1.
Today, review for Exam 1. I will walk you through what I expect you to know, and then it is your turn to ask me. If you ask me, is this going to be on the exam, and it's not on the exam, I will say, no, that's not on the exam. I'm going to be as specific as I can without handing you, well, actually, I suppose I could just put the exam up on the overhead here for you to see. No, I won't do that, no. Dream on. Okay. I'll walk through it structurally first. Part one is 10 multiple choice questions. Or multiple guess, if that's your tendency. Part one is 10 multiple choice questions. Part two is 5 matching questions. Part three is workout problems. Now, in that regard, obviously some of the questions would have multiple parts. So if I said there are, well, let me see here. If I said, for example, that there are 4 questions, that sort of understates what you're going to be doing because there are multiple pieces to some of the questions. And then the last part, part 4, is short essay. And I'll go through the parts, some in more detail than others. There's not a lot of detail I can give you about part 1. It's free-for-all, spans anything that I could have talked about. I never ask a question about material that's in the book that I have not covered in class or in an assigned reading. So it would be something that you have heard, each question would, at least in the classroom and quite possibly in the classroom and in the book. So again, it's somewhat difficult for me to cover everything that you should know. So let me put it this way. You should know everything. Now, I don't give you trick questions, although, and I don't have to because some questions are, by their nature, somewhat tricky. Keep in mind that in writing test questions at a professional level, we don't call the wrong answers wrong answers. We call them distractors, and there's a reason for that. The answers that are incorrect are designed to distract you from the right answer. Here's the rule, and if you were taking one of my prep courses for an ACT, an SAT, a GRE, an MCAT, or for a GMAT, you would get the same statement. When you read one of my questions, or when you read a question that's multiple choice, get the answer before you look at the answers that are available. Because if you start looking at the answers that are available, those distractors are going to do just what they're intended to do. They're going to distract you. So find the answer in your mind and then seek it out in the possible choices. That's a strong piece of advice, not just for my exams, but for exams that are written by professional test writers in general. I cannot comment on those who write questions without a lot of training and background in it. But for me, definitely. Make sure that you are in full understanding of basic essential definitions that I've given you in the course. This is where you might see problems like that is in the multiple choice. Details about how the Federal Reserve works, about financial intermediation, about the ratios themselves and what they indicate, what their possible values are, what's considered something that is dire or something that's considered good, possibly, although that's difficult to say with ratio analysis, okay? But again, things like the Federal Reserve, ratios, interest rates, those kinds of questions, where there's sort of a basic understanding I'm looking for risk, different kinds of risk. And we've looked at risk in several different ways. We looked at it from the perspective of business risk versus operating leverage and operating leverage versus financial risk. We also looked at risk in terms of coefficient of variations. We also looked at risk in terms of volatility as measured by beta. So know about risk for this section too. Now the matching section is designed to be relatively straightforward. It's not easy, but I'm trying to build up your confidence so I can destroy your confidence later. Your hopes and dreams go down the drain, and you join Ace Trucking School and learn how to be a real manly man driving trucks. Okay? That's what I'm trying to do, is build up your confidence before it gets shattered later. No. Just be careful. The matching can catch you. Now, the way the matching works, it's mostly like odd detail. I might put a 12 on one side, and then you have to find what matches 12. Oh, well, the number of governors of the board, nope. Well, that might be the members of the Federal Open Market Committee. Yeah, that might do it. Or something along that line. Or I might give you a little formula on one side and then give the name of that formula on the other side. It's a detail oriented, but you should be able to get it very easily. And it's to help build up your points, because there are sections, and I will be quite honest with you, where you're going to get your ass kicked. Okay? So I try to create a balance. And why I do all the different types of questions on an exam is because I'm playing to the different strengths. Some people are much better at multiple choice. Some people are better at workout. Okay, now part three. Those are the workout questions. Now, in the class, when we're doing problems and on quizzes, I'm pretty easygoing on making mistakes, because God knows I make mistakes too. This is live fire. This is where you don't make mistakes. Partial credit is unusual. It's not commonly given. Having the right idea doesn't cut it when you've made a mistake that cost a financial institution $10 million. They will not care if you had the right idea. So on this exam, stay frosty, get your answers, double check them. You will have time to do that. Just make sure that you get them right. Now, let me give you some detail. I will ask you a question. I'll give you financials. They'll be on the exam, financial statements in the appendix, and you will find some ratios. Specifically, I'll ask you for 5 different ratios. Know all of the ratios I taught you, not just the ones in the book. Know all of them that I taught you. I'm a real financial analyst, and there are ratios that the book doesn't mention that I consider to be important for you to know. So you'll have a set of financials at the back of the exam, and all those are for is to get you to be able to calculate some ratios that I give you, 5 of them. Okay? So do make sure that you have your ratio knowledge down. And then as far as the next question goes, that will be late tonight. The numbers for that question will be posted on isu-prof.com. The numbers, nothing more. You've got to figure out what those numbers are used for. That's your job. You should know right away, I know what kind of problems we did those for. I better bust my extra butt cheek and get this done so that you know what the answers should be. You'll have time. Because this kind of problem is just it will just absorb time on an exam if you don't have the knowledge down, if you don't have the answers at least partially prepared for the exam. I will ask you some time value of money questions. Some of them will just be very simple, find the present value of a lump sum, that kind of thing, or how much you have to put in an account to have a certain amount X years later, that kind of thing. I've shown you these problems on the board. You should be able to do these with your eyes closed. Always make sure, first of all, that you do a reality check. Always make sure that you ask yourself, does this answer make sense to me? If it doesn't pass the smell test, go back. And it does not hurt to check your answer, to do it again. Don't look at your original work. Just do it again from scratch. Again, you have time to do this. You have 1 hour and 15 minutes to accomplish this exam. It will begin at 3:35 and it will end at 4:50. And there is no slack at 4:50. I am just simply, 4:51 rather, I simply am gone. That keeps people from trying to lead on for a few extra minutes. By the way, just in that regard, I'll also ask you for an effective yield, okay? Just know how to do effective yields. I'm trying to be as straight as I can with you. My job here is not to trick you. This is a very straightforward course. A skill set is my objective for you to develop. And as I told you before, I'm going to have you calculate a loan payment. I told you that, and I will have you do that. So know how to do it. And if you are thinking about this, this is where you can really rack points well. Don't make mistakes, and remember my rules. If it's a percentage, you write a percentage to two decimal places. If you don't do that, you lose a point. If you don't follow the rules of the house, and I'm not doing that because I'm an asshole. Yes, I am an asshole. But when you get into the business world, don't be freewheeling and do things your way. If there's a house way, do it the house way. That's how you keep from getting clipped off in the business world. Don't try to be fancy and stick out above the crowd, because that's the first way to get yourself hurt. So I say if it's a percentage, you write percent, and you write it as a percent, and you do it as two decimal places, and you put the percent sign. If it is a multiplier, you put a times by it, to show me that you understand that this is a multiplier, not a percentage. On the quiz, some of you did, some of you didn't. This is not where you get sloppy. You stay tight. Now, the last section. This is where you'll have the most problem. Short answers. There are four of them. I tell you to tell me something, or I ask you a question. You are to give me the answer in one complete sentence, grammatically correct. You don't do a complete sentence, you lose a point. You do bad grammar, you make a grammar mistake, or you make a spelling mistake, or you text message language me. God, that pisses me off. Oh, God. Okay, that will snap my thong. And here's another thing that will absolutely make my hind leg go up and down. Don't ever, on a business communication, say, I feel, I think, or I believe. I feel that the interest rate structure is, don't do that. I don't care what you feel, what you believe, or even what you think. I want to know what you know. And I'm trying to shape you so that when you go out there, you are ready for that business world to communicate as a professional. You would not believe the number of executives and managers who say how much it pisses them off when they get communication in broken sentences, text messaging language, responses to emails that start with, I feel that we should. They tell me, I don't like this. And they'll mark you as someone that they don't like, as someone who's sloppy. So when you give me an answer, say what you have to say in one sentence. No more, because I do have a bullshit stamp. I really do. And I will hit that second sentence with bullshit. I promise. It's red, and I just got it re-inked yesterday. I really did. Over at Office Depot. The young man looked at it. What is this? I said, I'm a professor. Oh, shit, man. Okay. See, I'm serious. This is where I am trying to get you in the live fire environment to be able to give me straight answers. These are answers, and don't be creative. Don't be creative and stop reaching with your damn foot for the pencil. Don't be creative. I'm looking for a specific thing in these answers. This is not Zen. This is not art. We're business people. We aren't creative. Don't try to be. It's embarrassing. I'm looking for a very specific answer when I ask you in these questions. There is a right answer. There's this thing, I've taught English, and when I was an English teacher, you'd give these essays, you give these assignments, and it was kind of like, well, where do I draw the line between what I consider to be a creative response and what the student's creative internal thinking and energy is? That's not how we do it in business. There's a right answer, there's a wrong answer. If you give me the right answer, you get the full points, and that makes me happy because it doesn't drag me down. But believe me, if I hit an answer and I skid to a stop and I'm trying to figure out what the hell you said, that's when the points start flying off it. Just tell me what you know and be specific with me. These are not, again, creative. I'm looking for specific information in these essay questions. And that's a good way to approach when you go out there in the business world. If a superior asks you a question directly or in an email message, the sharper and tighter your answer is, the more you are going to impress that superior. If you go over five times around the barn to get to the outhouse, it's going to affect how he or she perceives you. Trust me on this. I know this because I have dinner with these people. I converse with these people. I'm reflecting for you in this place what will be the hotbed out there. So I might ask you a question along the line. This won't be one of the questions. Don't get excited. But a very similar question. What is the risk structure of an interest rate? And your answer is, in a complete sentence, the risk structure of an interest rate is the sum of the default premium, the maturity premium, and the illiquidity premium. That's it. That's the answer. Anything you deviate, any longer answer, anything that is more creative than that, you start to lose points. See how specific the answer is. It's not a lot of creativity in it. I want you to tell me in a complete sentence. Don't start an answer with because. That doesn't begin a complete sentence. I'm sure somewhere in your dark past you probably heard that. Because is not the beginning of an independent clause. Now, as far as these questions go, they're anywhere from the course. They could be something that was in the book and the lecture, or they could have been something that I spent time on in the lecture itself. I will tell you this, that with these answers like this, in this section, it wouldn't be something passing that I mentioned. It might be that in a multiple choice question, something I just said, oh, by the way, here's something. But if it's one of these essay questions, short answer questions, they're not really essay, they're short answer questions. These are something that I would have made clear this is an important thing by time or by how loudly I yelled and farted about it. Right? It's your turn. Ask me. What do you want to know? As Clint Eastwood would have said, go ahead, make my day. Anyone have anything? Yes, go ahead.
One over RRR.
One over.
Whatever the risk rate of return, whatever, yeah.
One over RRR.
Yeah,
that's the money multiplier.
Yeah, the required reserve ratio.
Yes, no, I won't ask about it.
Okay, good.
No. If you ask me a specific question, I will give you a no on it. So that's something you don't have to study. That's more time to study other things that won't be on the exam. Okay? It wasn't a ratio. It was a required reserve ratio, the money multiplier, required reserve ratio of one of the three tools of monetary policy. And I will not ask you to calculate a money multiplier. Go.
You have to know the rules of monetary policy.
You might very well. You might have to know something about those. Not the rules, but the three tools of monetary policy, which were the required reserve ratio, the discount rate, and the open market operations. But I would not ask you to do a mathematical calculation using the required reserve ratio. No, I won't. Go.
Tools of monetary policy.
Say that again.
Volatility of sales.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. There will be volatility. Wait, let me come up there. Well, say that again.
Quiz four?
I already did, didn't I?
I don't think so.
No. Well, we'll go over that right in just a minute. Yeah, sure. What else do you have to ask? Yes, there will be betas. I believe me. I mean, I am the Freddy Krueger of beta. I come to you in your nightmares and scare the hell out of you with beta. Yeah, beta is a key concept in finance, and so that would be something that would be a core objective for me to aim for. What else do we have? Yeah. Any what? No. No, you won't have to do any fill in the blanks of an accounting statement. If I am correct, your financial statements are already completed for you. Realistically, this is something that you would never have to do in your life unless the accountant had died right in the middle of completing the accounting statements, in which case you would have to complete them. But given that accountants live very long lives, it's very unlikely that you would ever have to do that work for an accountant. Well, go ahead. Marginal tax rates. No. I was going to do that, and then I decided on this one. I wasn't. No. Let me give you a little background. Obviously, there are my exams are out there floating around from other semesters. I don't deviate hugely. The structure is very similar. However, I do change the actual questions. Sometimes you might see an exam of mine from last year that has a calculation of a marginal tax rate. This year you wouldn't see it. You'd see something else. So it varies. The marginal tax rate right now, I'm kind of waiting to see where the smoke clears because we will have a new marginal tax rate structure at least within the next year, and I don't want to get too much into committing myself to having you do one right now. Good. Other things? What else?
Do we have to know the securities trading, the money and capital markets?
You should know that general area. I don't want to be circumspect, but that's about as specific as I can get. Remember, I did a pretty intensive part where I was talking about all of the things about financial intermediation, economic surplus units, economic deficit units, and the different concepts that are involved, liquidity, why you have different clienteles for different financial institutions. There could be something about that on the exam. A couple of passes at that entire a globe of thinking.
As far as like the treasury bills.
I could very well hit you with something about T-bills, and why T-bills are important in finance. And I keep returning to the T-bill in several different contexts. I've brought up the T-bill. You remember, as in capital market versus money market, as in liquidity versus illiquidity, as in open market operations, as in proxy for the risk-free rate. I've brought up the T-bill enough times, and also how to calculate using the T-bill to be able to calculate a yield and see this underlying fundamental principle of finance that yield and price are inversely related. So because the T-bill has come up so often, it would be something that I would consider a touchstone that would be brought up at least once, probably more than once, hint, 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 nudge, nudge, wink, wink, on an exam. Okay? That's as specific as I'll get.
Effects on cash flows.
Say that again.
The effects on cash flows.
No, I was going, that's another thing. Sometimes I ask, sometimes I don't. Remember the plus minus table and all that? Not directly. I actually, if I recall right, one of my multiple choice questions was about that, and I took it out and decided that I'd put something else in its stead this time. Yeah.
Monetary policy.
Very possibly. Very monetary policy. Remember, what's the most important tool of monetary? Well, let's start this. What would be the tool of monetary policy least likely to be used actively by the Fed? You're sorry you asked that. It's a required reserve ratio. That's the one that, it's like a meat axe. That's the one that changes the actual money multiplier. You play with that thing, and it's like pushing the rocket engine on your Ford Escort. You don't want to do that too often. But on the other hand, the discount rate, what's the important word when I say discount rate that I emphasized in this class? Do you remember? Signal. Signal. And I brought up that concept that signaling is important to think about in finance because the discount rate is by and large historically a signal. And we see other signaling behaviors in business. Signaling, remember the other example I told you about signaling in finance? What was it? Where we see signaling as an important, we can't really explain this phenomenon except as a signaling device. You remember what it was? What?
Wasn't it when two graphs split, they go inverse?
No, that's correlation. Yeah? Dividends. There's no logical reason for a company to pay a dividend unless it's saying, we can't figure out what to do with this money we made. We're so lame and stupid, we can't find good positive net present value projects. So that doesn't make sense why they give a dividend unless it's dominant. The dominant motivation is to signal the ability of the company to sustain that kind of a surrender of cash to the investors, to the owners. Yeah.
Do we have to not describe credit unions?
Curse you, Wolfman. You bit me on the ass. There is this.
Just say it.
Will you stop it? It's not that easy. Yes, I will. I've said I love you way too many times and I'm so sorry in the morning. What the hell am I thinking? See, my problem is that credit unions, by and large, I'm not going to ask you a question about credit unions.
What credit union gives you the best APR on your loan?
No, but there is an importance to credit unions that transcends credit unions. It has to do with money. Okay, that's all I'm going to tell you. It has to do with money. And on this exam, I am going to ask you about money. We're in business. Money is important to us. Money does buy happiness. Don't let anyone lie to you. Gandhi was lame. He wore a loincloth. Money is important. And in this class, I have talked about money in sort of a theoretical but a very real sense. And your question, the reason I'm having a hard time is I don't want to dismiss credit unions because credit unions are a resource for talking about a certain kind of money. Okay? And I'm not going to go any further than that. What else? Bank regulation. I was going to hit you with that thing, and then I couldn't remember who regulates what part of the banking industry, so I took the question out. The state. Okay, let's try this one. Who regulates state chartered banks?
Federal, 12
member banks. Huh? Okay. Without any further information, you would say the Federal Reserve. Who manages federal banks that are members of the FDIC? No, the FDIC does. okay? And you say, wait, duh. But there are, the regulatory structure is so, it's ridiculous. And there has got to be, I mean, when they talk about reform, they are beating around the bush. This is something that's very obvious. Some single institution that will oversee and regulate the entire banking industry. We don't have that now. But at the same time, I actually was going to put a question on that, and then I thought, well, I am not all that clear on some of the details of the structure, so I laid off that. So no, I won't ask you who regulates what. Besides which, if we have any kind of reform at all of the financial industry, that will certainly be reformed and we'll have some kind of simplification of the regulatory structure. Although I'm losing all hope of meaningful reform as the weeks go by. What else? Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily give you earnings per share. Now, yeah, well, you know, if you have the earnings and you have the number of shares, you can do the earnings per share. And I want to make absolutely sure that there's not some confusion about that. If I give you the total dividend and I give you the number of shares, you should be able to calculate the dividend per share that was issued. So consider me your mother. I will chew the food some, but I won't chew it all the way because you do have to cut your teeth somewhat, okay? Good. And don't call me mother. What else? Now, as far as that one question goes, I didn't realize I hadn't done some volatility with you. I hadn't completed that volatility question with you. Where the hell is that thing? See if I can find that quiz in this mass of quizzes that I have given here. Oh, Lord. God, what a mess. Was that the one where the... it was Power Software Company and Probability Power Software Company. Yeah. Hang on here. Give me just a moment here. As a matter of fact, if I have it here, do I have it? Huh. It's kind of rattling me that I didn't go through that with you. Grr. Huh. Hang on, bear with me. Give me just a minute. Just realized something here, too, about this exam. But bear with me. There's the blanks of that quiz that I didn't turn back. Well, I'll be darned. Could have sworn. Oh, here it is. Now, when you do a problem with calculating volatility, if I am asking you for risk, if I'm talking about risk metrics, unless it's clear that we are in the territory of beta, the risk metric is the CV, the coefficient of variation. Now, to get the CV, you have to first get the mean of the possible cash flows. And then from the mean, you have to get the standard deviation, which is the one that grinds you down, and it's the one where there is the most likelihood that you will err in the calculation. Let me write down some things here for you. With respect to that quiz 4, all I had was the sales, and I said, calculate the business risk from sales. Now remember, business risk comprises the composite of the volatility of sales magnified by fixed costs. Volatility of the variable costs do not contribute to business risk. Know that. Volatility of, rather, variable costs do not contribute to to business risk simply because they are riding directly with the sales. So they don't cause any magnification effect at all on sales. So when you calculate the probabilities of occurrence, you use those probabilities of occurrence for that table, and I gave you 2% chance the sales would be 800, 8% chance the sales would be 1,000, 25% chance that sales would be 1,400, 30% chance the sales would be 2,000, 25% chance that they'd be 2,600, 8% chance that they'd be 3,000, and 2% chance, ha, that was weird, 3,200. Oh, 3,200. Yeah, I guess that does work out symmetrically. The first thing you have to do is calculate the mean, which is the sum of each possible cash flow times the probability of occurrence of that cash flow across the n possible, the n scenarios. Just take each cash flow times the probability of occurrence, add them up. And that will get you your expected value, which should, for my problems, land either on the mean, on the center or very close to the center. It's not necessarily true that it will always land on the center. I recall last semester my problem, actually the mean did not land on the center. But this time, this semester, I'm doing much more symmetry. Okay, so in this case, for problem one, if you calculate the mean, the expected value, you will find, surprise, surprise, that the expected value of the cash flows is $2,000. It sits right in the center. Don't always assume that, though. Don't always assume that. But the next one is the one that's the where you can make the mistake. That's the one that will grind you down, too. Because to calculate the standard deviation sigma, you are going to take the square root of a ginormous mess. You're going to sum for over the n possible states each cash flow minus the mean. That gives you the difference between a given cash flow and the center of the distribution. You square it to keep the negative and positive deviations from canceling each other out. And then finally, you scale it by its probability of occurrence, that deviation's probability of occurrence. You do that for each of the cash flows minus the mean, squaring it, times its probability, add them up, and then you will get your standard deviation. You just do it slowly, methodically, carefully, and check your answer, and you will be, if you're fortunate, you'll get the right answer. And in this case, it's 630.56. Now, there's something significant about this 630.56, because I know that there's a 67% chance that the actual cash flow would occur between the mean minus this 630.56 and the mean plus that 630.56. Sales have a 67% chance of being in that interval right there. They have a 95% chance of being between 2,000 minus 2 times 630.56 and 2,000 plus 2 times 630.56. And they have a 99% chance of being between the mean minus 3 times standard deviation and the mean plus 3 times the standard deviation. Now, my language there is awfully loose, technically incorrect, but that's the best way that I can describe it in shorthand. Go ahead. That's just probability. Those are not for this course. It's not something I calculate. Don't sweat. I know, right? It's like those are just from probability tables for normal distributions. It's just the way it works. If you've got a standard normal distribution, well, not a standard normal, the mean is right here. 67% of the area. 67% of the area of a bell curve is from the mean minus one standard deviation to the mean plus one standard deviation. And then 95% of that area, it's from stats course. Have you guys had your, I might have asked this, did you guys have your stats course yet? Have you taken that yet? Okay. Yeah, I was going to be teaching the econ stats version, but they said I was ugly. So... But yeah, that's just from that. And you know, I just know those spreads there. Now, the last thing we do is the CV. And the coefficient of variation is nothing but the standard deviation scaled by the mean. That makes all of these that we would look at, regardless of the company, regardless of what layer of the financial statement we look at, comparable. The CV sort of is like a standard. And the CV is a percentage. The CV is a percentage. So in this case, if I calculate the coefficient of variation, it comes out to be 31.53%. Okay? And I encourage you, make sure you can get these. Yeah. Yeah. N is the number of states of possible occurrence. In this case, N is 5. In other words, go through all 5 states. Do this for all 5 of the different scenarios. Yeah, yeah. I'm throwing a little bit of fancy mathematical terminology for you here. It makes it look great when you put your notes out where your friends can see them. They're impressed. And that's about it. Okay, now... without knowing anything else, if I subtract the variable cost from the sales, what should the CV come out to be? The same number. So obviously, the mean and the standard deviation should come out to be the same, right? Wrong. They'll come out to be different things. Well, they'll come out to be different. But when you take the standard deviation over the mean, well, I'll be darned, it will come out to be the same number. So don't think that just because the CV is the same, the mean and the standard deviation will be the same. They won't be. But it will come out that the CV will be the same. So in number 2, where I have you take out the variable cost, you find that the mean comes out to be $800. The standard deviation comes out to be $252.22. But spank me, Mohammed, the coefficient of variation comes out to be 31.53%. Now, I recall, interestingly enough, that there were a few papers where the CVs came out to be different by a couple hundredths of a percent. They should be exactly on the button, the same, exactly the same number. So when I say what is the contribution to business risk from sales net of variable costs, you say, well, that's the same as the contribution to business risk of sales themselves. Now remember, the business risk is the volatility at the what line of the financial statements. What's business risk? Where am I actually calculating the full business risk by CV? EBIT. Operating margin. EBIT or operating margin. So in other words, after sales, take out variable costs, take out fixed costs, that's your full business risk. And so as in number three, we will get a different number. But something interesting is going to happen here when I do this number here. Number three, where I calculate the coefficient of variation of operating income, or EBIT, which is a better term, I guess, I find that the mean has dropped to $650. But interestingly enough, look, notice this number right here. Notice that in three, the CV will be different. The CV comes out, the coefficient of variation comes out to be 38.80%. But notice that the sigma, the standard deviation, hasn't changed. Now here's why. So if you know the detail of how these work, you can save yourself time. If you calculated the sigma for number two, you know the sigma for number three. Okay? So that saves you having to do the pain in the ass part of the calculation again. But why does the sigma stay the same? Because of fixed costs. Remember, sigma measures the spread of the distribution, the spread out. Fixed costs just slide the distribution. They don't change the spread. So that's why sigma will stay the same. Coefficient of variation changes because mu is changing, but mu is easy to calculate. So there's a kind of a reasonableness. Well, sigma shouldn't be different. It's all you did was slide the distribution. You didn't change its spread at all. But CV did change. This is business risk. That's a metric. That's our metric of business risk. Right there, that's the end of it. Then we can say, okay, clearly, the CV at the EBIT line is different from the CV before we take out fixed costs. So there is a contribution to business risk from number two to number three, the contribution of fixed costs to business risk. So we can now say that the business risk metric we use tells us that it's a 38.80% volatility, and the contribution of fixed costs would be to that business risk is 38.80% less 31.53%, which comes out to be 0.27. Seven? Oh, I can do that. Get off me. I know that. Yeah. All right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, now. So, by the way, what do we call that? What do we call that 7.27%? It has a name. What is it?
Operating
leverage. That is the magnification of volatility being caused by our fixed costs. Okay, now, and then the last thing that I had you do was drive it down to take out the interest expense and then calculate the volatility one more time, which allows us to see the contribution to total risk of the interest expense, which is called what we call financial leverage. Now, one last thing here with number four. The mean comes out to be 590. Sigma stays the same as it did in 3 and in 2. It's $252.22. So when you take CV, you would get 252.22 divided by 590. And so you would get the coefficient of variation at the level of EBT of 42.575%. So the contribution of financial leverage to the total risk in this case is going to be 42.75% minus GER 38.80%. And so that will come out to be 3.95%. Now, last question though. That sigma stayed the same again. Why? Go, you said it. I think you said it. What is it? Yeah, it's just another fixed cost. Yeah, so it's not changing the spread. So actually, by the time you get to number two, sigma is done. You're done with sigma. And that means that really, in one of these problems, even though they look like monsters, mofos, the hardest part of them, the calculation of the sigma, as long as you stay frosty and get it right on the first two, you don't have to worry about it again. Of course, you got to make sure that you get it right on the first two or everything goes to hell after that. But, you know, as you see the point I'm making, though, is that these problems, once you understand the structure of how we do these calculations of CV, it's really easy after the first couple of steps. All you're really doing is calculating means and then getting CVs. Okay? So I want you to keep that in mind. Yeah, go ahead.
We have to know the capital asset price model.
Oh, yes. Not in detail yet, but I will touch upon it. I focus more on CAPM after the exam, but I do test you on it here, because it begins to kind of pervade our thinking in finance.
We have to be able to calculate the time value of money with uneven cash flow?
No. He wanted to know, what if I, would I give you one where there were an, there was an uneven cash flow? The answer is no. I will do that on the second exam. On this exam, all I'm doing is testing your fundamental ability to find present values of lump sums and payments using the level annuity, present value of level annuity formula. On the second exam, I'll go into a little more detail. Like I said, you can get stupidly complicated with those, and only if I have to would I get stupidly complicated with them. And fortunately, I really don't have to. So even on the second exam, it's not going to be that hard. What else do you have for me? Yeah. Okay, here's the deal. 4x6, both sides. 4x6 note card, formula card, both sides. And that's all you have. Don't write so damn small I can't, you ask me to read it to you, which I actually had last semester. Guy wrote like micro pro. What the hell did you? Oh, and then of course I had some fool. He made an 8.5x11 sheet and then he photo reduced it. You know, it was just like little blur lines, and it didn't do so well on the exam. Go, yeah, other question. Go ahead. Yeah. Not here. Oh, praise God. Yeah. No, that the open market operations, I will probe in detail. Not here, though. Not in the finance class. I do want you to know how it works as an outline, but the buying and selling of T-bills, not yet, not here. Other questions? Yeah.
Are we going
to
find
tax
on EBT?
No. That was asked before. Some semesters I do that. Now, if you see, like I said, my old exams are out there in different places, some in trash, some in the toilet. But you'll see some semesters I do ask to calculate. Some semesters I don't. I change up a few questions every semester. This semester, no, I won't. About calculating the tax, the total taxes on a taxable income of a corporation. I mean, those kinds of problems are detailed, fraught with peril, and right now, because our tax structure is going to have to change, it's going to have to, there's not a whole lot of point in doing one right yet, right now. What else? Anything else? Yeah, go ahead. Say what?
Securities.
What about them? That was a broad question. You know. Dude, everything we're doing is securities. Stocks versus bonds? Well, yeah, you should know the difference. Oh, know the difference. Oh, let me be specific. You need to know the difference between a bill, a note, and a bond. I'll tell you that right now. You'll need to know the difference between a bill, a note, and a bond. Go ahead. You mean the Federal Reserve video? Nothing that I wouldn't have said in class. Oh, yeah, Federal Reserve under fire. You should know the details of the technical structure of the Fed as I described it. In the second one, I went into total ass-tearing polemics. In the first one, it was very detailed, explained this is the structure of the Fed. Okay, and it was that first one where I gave detail that you might need to know. Yeah. Not huge detail. I'm not going to ask you who is the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve who is about to resign instead of taking another term because he's so sick of what's happening and he's scared to death of what's about to hit the fan. I wouldn't ask you that. But I might ask you who the chairman is. I don't think I do. Maybe I do. But I might ask you who the chairman is right now. Anything? Who's? Oh, you can look that up. Ben Bernanke, Uncle Ben. Go on Joe's door. Do any of you know Professor Joe here? There's a professor downstairs. I make political graphics, and I had a political graphic that I made. It was a picture that was taken of Ben Bernanke when he was before the Senate trying to tell why we were in a financial crisis that almost made the planet come to a halt. And he's sitting there, and he's got his eyes closed, and he's got his hands like this. The man looked like he was praying, and right in front of the Senate. And so I made a picture of one of those motivational posters. Underneath it, I said, market signal. Sell! Apparently, the humor was lost on some, but Professor Joe got the humor. What else? Yeah. No. I regret that I did not do that, static and dynamic efficiency. I regret that I didn't bring that up on the exam, but I did not. And again, you asked me a specific question, I'm giving you a specific answer. Go ahead.
What's the beta of 2.5?
A beta of 2.5, well, let me ask you that. Does that mean that it has 250% of the volatility of the market portfolio? No, it does not. It has 250% of the volatility of the market, of the non-diversifiable risk of the market premium. First of all, beta measures non-diversifiable risk, not all risk. Second, it's not measuring the volatility of the market portfolio. It's measuring the volatility of the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. So the market, the expected return to the market minus the risk-free rate is the market premium. How much you earn for investing in the market portfolio above what you would earn by just investing risk-free, like in T-bills. So what beta measures is the magnification by which you are rewarded for bearing the non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio over risk-free investment. So if I told you that the expected return to the market portfolio is 10% and the risk-free rate proxy by a T-bill is 2%, the market premium is expected to be 8%. So now if you told me a beta was 2, I would tell you that that stock's non-diversifiable risk was twice the premium on 8%. The premium of 8%. It sounds nuanced, really does. But there's a crucial difference. And if you don't show me that you have that nuance of difference some way, there's a question on the exam about this couple, in fact. If you don't show me that you have that nuance, you won't get the answer right. Okay? So it's a nuance. It's probably one of those subtle concepts that separates. You have these pundits talk all the time on the TV and the radio, especially the TV. And they somewhere in their past, I know most of these guys had profs that taught them right, but they have deviated so far from their fundamentals just so they can make a buck talking that and selling their stuff and their selling their own knowledge, which is limited, that they are misleading people about what constitutes risk, what constitutes a risk that you are rewarded for in a market. You're not rewarded for all the risk you bear. You expect to be rewarded only for part of that risk. Make sure you know the two different types of risk. I'll tell you that right now. Make sure you know them. Okay? There are two different types of risk inherent in any security, except for a government T-bill. What else? You asked a hell of a lot of good questions this time. That's an indication that you're going to study your asses off, right? You're not going to do anything but study for this exam for the next 2 days, right? Okay, I just want to make sure. I don't want to see you at DP Dose or anything like that eating. Yeah. Say that again? No, you will not have to know those for this exam. I will touch upon that genre of topics later in the semester. I will go back to it. But you will not need to know the Federal Reserve Act for this exam. But I will revisit the Federal Reserve with teeth a little later in the course again, and that's where I'll get the chance on the second exam. I will probe you much more deeply on open market operations and that kind of stuff, but not this time. Yeah. No. Although you should know what it means to be a corporation and how a corporation happens. What it means to be a corporation as opposed to some other type of firm. Because in these courses, we focus primarily on the corporate form. And so you should know what constitutes the corporate form and how that happens. And what it means. What else? Yeah. No. No. I will go back through that a little later in the course. He wanted to know, I did a brief thing where I was talking about the different types of offerings that a company could do, like its IPO or its initial public offering. And you had the underwritten offerings and the best efforts offerings and the terms like syndication of the offering and all that kind of stuff. I will not ask you about that here, but again, I am going to make another pass. There's going to be a topic here that's not really probed well in the book, but it has to do with takeovers, mergers, acquisitions, and all that kind of stuff. That's not on this exam, but in the second half of the course, it's actually kind of fun to talk about different types of attack strategies, defense strategies, white knights, black knights, poison pills, and all that. But that comes later. And so I'll be revisiting that whole thing with LBOs and leverage and underwritings and the defense strategies later. Go.
Are the math problems like set up how the quizzes are? Like, are there tables?
There will be some tables. Remember, like a very coefficient of variation problem starts with a table, like quiz four. Yeah, and a financial statement is basically a table, and from that you would be generating ratios. Yeah. Bring a calculator, for God's sake. Like TIs, which one to use? Use whatever one you want. You can use your cell phone calculator. Do not call your friends, noob. They won't know any more than you do about this exam. But you can use, that's really butch. Although I do have to say, there's a cell phone, I don't know which one it is, that has an awesome financial calculator on it. I can't remember which one it is. It might be just an app on the iPhone. But you can use whatever calculator you want. For this exam, you would need to be able to do hierarchical operations, order of operations, and you would need to do squares and square roots. I'm not sure you would need to do anything more than that for this exam, though. Yeah.
Thank you.
The what? You do not have to show any work. Work will get you, if you get the wrong answer, work could get you a minimal amount of partial credit. Some, not a lot. But it's that last answer that's really what matters in this. Like I said, this is live fire. We can screw up in the class and on quizzes. I'm really lenient. But here, that last answer is what's going to matter. God knows I screw up enough in my math. I so suck at arithmetic. Anything else?
No detail
about DuPont. The DuPont?
Yeah.
No. Don't ask DuPont. I'm not going to ask DuPonts. I like DuPonts, but DuPonts are more for analytics. In other words, you do the DuPont so you can see why some ratio did what it did. You can see the components of the ratio. I don't do the analytics on this exam. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.